Hello, I'm Mercedes Stevenson, and you're listening to The West Block. Ukrainians are preparing for a potentially brutal winter ahead as Russia continues to weaponize things like food, heat, and power. I sat down with Ukraine's Deputy Prime Minister Olga Stefanishynow to ask her what Ukraine needs from Western allies now to make it through this winter and this war, and how to stop Putin. Here's that conversation. Deputy Prime Minister Stefanishynow, thank you so much for joining us today and welcome to Canada.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me here today.
Can you describe for us what the situation is like right now for the people of Ukraine?
Well, we got used to live in darkness. Both being affected severely by multiple crimes committed against people, but also the first thing I noticed when I landed to Montreal is that there's so much light around you. This is not what we have. But I think that what is more important is the spirit. This is the spirit which cannot be undermined by any measures of demoralization Russia tries to put on Ukraine, whether it's destroying critical infrastructure, attacking residential buildings, massive torturing of population in the occupied areas, or any failure on a battlefield which forces them to use the hybrid warfare as a major method of their aggression. So I think that the major spirit in Ukraine is that there's no way to surrender. There's only way to victory. And this leads to a permanent failure of Russian Federation. Although, of course, the suffering and the losses among population are really, really serious.
And you talked about that lack of light. It's powerful because we take here for granted. You're right. The street lights are on. Our power grids are going. Ukraine, like Canada, is a cold country in the winter. And the Russians are attacking your power, your energy. That is such a danger for the civilian population. How do you deal with that?
I think that the most important thing that we have not been dealing with that only by ourselves. After the first massive shelling, counting around 90 rockets like 4 weeks ago, and this shelling are taking place on a weekly basis with the same massive missiles attacks throughout the area of Ukraine, we have not been standing alone. As President already said publicly, it's around 40% of the elements of the critical infrastructure throughout the Ukraine, mostly the central part of Ukraine, which is not affected by military warfare, has been damaged. It's really important that we are restoring back the infrastructure in a very fast and operative way. Basically, all our technicians are also the heroes, apart from the fact that they are not with a gun on the battlefield. But it would not be possible without a strong mobilization from our partners across European Union and wider group of allies. But it's also a very important sign that Russians has also failed to attack Ukrainian elements of the critical infrastructure through hybrid or cyber attacks. This has leave no room for them but to try to physically destroy what we have.
What does Ukraine need right now from the West and from countries like Canada? What can we do?
In terms of supporting the restoration of the electricity grids, of course, we have shared the list of our needs, and we encourage the companies operating in the electricity market to mobilize their efforts to provide us with everything which is needed. This is a very precise list of technical needs. Of course, we all need generators, and the more generators that we have, the better. It could ensure the security and stability of the networks. It can ensure the stability of the lightning in the residential buildings, but it also can ensure the stability of functioning of the state itself, because connection and electricity and energy is the basis of functioning of the country itself. So making sure that we have enough generators and we have enough technical elements which we need to make sure that we can address and be resilient towards this attack is important, but it's not as important as the ability to close the sky and to save our people, to save our lives, and to save our infrastructure. We need more anti-air defense systems, which will be which would enable us to restore the damaged infrastructure, to regain the sustainable reconstruction throughout the war, and to make sure that we save the lives of our people.
Do you feel that NATO countries are willing to give that to you? Are they listening?
Well, they are. There's been a significant breakthrough, I would say, in terms of providing Ukraine with entire defense means, let's say, from various countries, even from those countries like Spain, which has not been there before the first massive shelling. But this is the time where we should go beyond what we can. And that what we are doing on a daily basis in Ukraine, whether it's about military and armed forces of Ukraine, whether it's about those people providing humanitarian assistance or politicians and ministers who are doing everything possible to go beyond any measures and beyond any boxes. So if some of the allies still think that they've done everything they could, we assure you that you didn't, because the war is lasting. People are dying and the families are losing their loved ones.
Is that frustrating when you know what you need and you know your allies have the ability to give that to you and you're watching people who you know and care about die around you, but they're worried. They're worried about potentially escalating with Russia. They're worried about NATO being pulled into that. I'm wondering what that's like for you as you try to balance competing priorities but stand up for your people.
Yeah, personally, there's been a lot of frustration in the beginning of war because to some extent from Kyiv, from Ukraine, you see things much more clearer than many leaders and many politicians across our partner countries, because we're not so our ultimate goal is to survive and to save our people. There's no other balances we should ensure. So there's been a lot of personal frustration, but from the very beginning, we knew a couple of very principled issues. We do not take no for an answer if there's something we need to protect our people. And practice showed that it's a matter of time when partners are coming to the same conclusions. And we are now with a very coordinated military support provided through coordination through the Rammstein format. This is already a historical decision, but still we need more. And we hope that the very good coordination processes which has been established would allow to take decisions faster, to plan our military theater, let's say, in a more smooth and precise way, and will allow first and foremost to save the lives of our people who are dying.
Are you worried about the potential for a nuclear strike?
Of course we are, and we're extremely worried of the fact that this nuclear threat could be materialized through a massive provocation on the Ukrainian nuclear object, like Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, like Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Russians would never act bluntly by simply shelling the nuclear bomb to Kyiv. They would do the hybrid methods, and for us it's really important that first international partners and leaders would have the equal reaction to any nuclear blackmail or nuclear threat which will be posed by Russia, even if it's done through using Ukrainian nuclear objects like Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. But from the other hand, we understand that this nuclear threat will be hanging over all of us, regardless the fact whether we react strongly or not strongly. There will be such a threat as long as Putin is in power, as long as the war is there, as long as Russia has any hunger for any aggression, whether in Ukraine or Poland or any other country around the world. This threat will be there. The thing is that what we are doing, if we're like acting in a way that we do not want to irritate Russia, this nuclear threat will always be there, and this hunger for being unpunished will always be there. So we anyway call upon action to stop Russia, to end the war. And we should do it fast. We should do it in a coordinated way. And I think that it is us, Ukraine, and partners who should make the decision when the war is over, not the Russians.
And how do you make that decision?
Well, it's absolutely clear at this stage. President of Ukraine has announced the 10 points of the peaceful plan, whereas the negotiations is only one of the points. And I think that everybody should stick to this understanding, that this is a concentrated set of actions needed to be done on Ukrainian side. We will be moving on each of these points. This is the implementation of the MAGATE recommendations on the elimination of the nuclear threat, restoration of the grain corridor, exchange of all prisoners of war, bringing Russia to justice, then negotiations, and then security guarantees to Ukraine. So these are the key elements we will be moving towards regardless of any developments, and we hope that the partners will be sticking together with us. And then this will be the situation when we will be holding the file of the victory.
Deputy Prime Minister, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
The perilous situation created by Russia in Ukraine has been the talk of the forum, and it's top of mind for those who have to make life and death military decisions. Among those people, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who was here at the forum and addressed those who were present. Not just countries that surround Ukraine, he says, who face a risk, but also NATO and allies, including those of us here at home in Canada.
The outcome of the war in Ukraine will help determine the course of global security in this young century. And those of us in North America don't have the option of sitting this one out.
Austin said Russia's aggression is a clear and historic challenge, and he again vowed to defend every inch of NATO territory. Admiral Rob Bauer serves as NATO's most senior military officer. I sat down with him here in Halifax to talk about NATO's response to Russia's war on Ukraine and what's at stake. Admiral Rod Bauer, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Well, great to be here, Mercedes.
It is quite a time to be in your position at NATO. People thought the Cold War was over. Some still say it is, but the world and the way that the alliance works has changed tremendously. What do you believe the biggest threat to NATO is right now? Is it Russia?
Yes. It is Russia and the terror groups still, because that was the sort of threat that we thought would go away with operations far away from home, but that's not true. It is still there. So we have two threats defined for NATO, and that's what we are working on all these plans to make sure that we deter and deter those threats in principle, and if it's necessary, to defend against them.
How concerned are you that Russia is willing to cross the line into a NATO country?
We have not seen any evidence of the Russians intending to do that. But it is important to be prepared for it. That's what we're doing. And so the message to Russia is that we are not part of the war in Ukraine as NATO. And at the same time, we are ready to defend ourselves. And that readiness has gone up. Our ability to do that has gone up. We have placed 8 battle groups along the eastern flank after the start of the war. As a result of the changed posture of Russia, because it's not only Russia in Ukraine, but it's also Russia in Belarus. And it is about a more aggressive intent from President Putin. So we need to be ready to defend ourselves more than a couple of years ago.
What does your intelligence say about Putin's calculus on that? Is he worried about confronting NATO? Is that something that he thinks there's a low chance of? When the Russians are doing their calculations for targeting, we all know they don't have great accuracy, so accidents can happen. But in terms of deliberate provocations or testing of limits or testing of responses, what are you seeing about how Vladimir Putin is thinking this through?
Yeah. We don't see that there is an intent in terms of trying to test NATO other than what he has done in terms of our unity and our ability to remain united in response to what he did on the 24th of February. I don't think President Putin expected a united NATO the way we were and still are. I don't think he expected a united European Union the way it was and still is. He didn't expect a united States and Europe the way it is. So in many ways, he made the wrong calculations. And I think he thought that if he was able to basically kick out President Zelensky and take over Ukraine in a matter of less than 2 weeks, then he would get away with it. And he hasn't.
With the incident in Poland, take us inside those discussions. How close were you to Article 5?
I would say What was extremely important after it happened is the calm and measured and professional response from the Polish authorities. And they were basically saying, you know, we have to investigate this. It is a serious thing. There's two people killed. There's an explosion. And so we have to find out what happened. But before we make any assessment or any conclusion, we will have to find out what happened. And basically, it of course happened in the dark. It was raining, so it took a while. But then in the early hours of the next morning, it became clear that it was the result of a Ukrainian missile that actually was defending, was used in defense of its own of Ukraine, as a result of the huge missile attacks by the Russians that day. And so the announcement or the press conference from Secretary General after the North Atlantic Council convened the next morning at 10 o'clock Brussels time, and I think his press conference was like 12:15, the statement was, this is the result, this is not a deliberate attack from Russia. This is the result of a defensive action from Ukraine, and Russia still is to be blamed for this, because if they didn't start the war on 24 February, this would have never happened. So I think Poland has to be commended for the way, they responded. There was no panic. It was very, very professional. And I think as an alliance, as a whole, we never panicked, and we were measured, professional, and calm.
So it sounds to me like you're saying the red line there, perhaps, is not a strike. It's being sure that it's a deliberate strike. How hard is that, though, when you're talking about the fog of war, as you just illustrated it, and how things are happening in real time? There's pressure to respond. People are frightened. How do you handle that?
Yeah. It's exactly as you said. It's the fog of war. So what you need to do in when you're driving around in a fog is to reduce speed a little bit to make sure that you're not hitting anything unintentionally. And I think that is what the alliance has done, to not jump to conclusions, but to actually look at it, to investigate it, to find out the facts, and then based on those facts to take a decision. And that will happen in any situation. So if the outcome would have been a deliberate attack, the outcome of the discussions might have been different. So I think it is very important to know the facts, then to have the discussion, and then the decision. And that's exactly what happened. So even with a deliberate attack, there will be an investigation. There will be a discussion, and then there will be, most likely, if it's a deliberate attack, a different outcome. But I think, as a result of the fog of war, as a result of the fact that in many cases you will have to take a little bit of time, unless there's a massive attack like the invasion in Ukraine from three directions, then it's not like, is this a deliberate attack? This is that is immediately clear. But if it is something like this, then we will take some time, not a lot, but some time to find out what it was and then take a decision.
NATO officially is not involved in this conflict, but NATO countries are contributing significant amounts of arms and other military supplies, including Canada. What is at stake for the Ukrainians in being able to maintain access to those sorts of abilities? And what happens if Ukraine loses this war?
If Ukraine, to start with the most important one, if Ukraine loses this war, it's not the end of hostilities. It's not the end of instability. It is the start of more instability. If Ukraine loses this war, we will see, based on the Russians' intentions, which is to restore the Russian Empire, to go back to the Soviet Union type of size of the Soviet Union. If that is the case, then the next nation might be Moldova, the next nation might be Georgia. So that is not the end of hostilities, but it is the start of the next hostility somewhere else. So it is therefore very important that Ukraine does not lose this war with Russia. It is important that if people think that if we would stop supporting Ukraine now because it is becoming too expensive for us, then actually that is not true, because the Russians will still use in other times and in other conflicts maybe food, energy, migration as a weapon. So that is not connected only to the war in Ukraine. It is connected to their intent to use everything they have to destabilize Europe and to break our unity. And I think they have not been successful. I don't really think it. I know they have not been successful. I see unwavering support. There is not the start of a crack in that unity. So I'm impressed by what has happened so far. But it is extremely important that we continue.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Admiral Bauer.
Well, it's a great honor and a pleasure to be here.
As the Halifax International Security Forum wraps up, discussions here about defense and security will change to discussions in Ottawa about national security, looking at the invocation of the Emergencies Act. We're expecting to hear from 8 cabinet ministers and the prime minister himself as they argue that they were justified in using the act. We'll take a look at that and all their testimony next week here on the West Block. That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back here next Sunday. I'm Mercedes Stevenson for the West Block.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.